Hi, Jonah.
Hey, Bob. How's it going?
Not too bad. How are you?
I'm good. I'm particularly honored to be sitting in for Mickey.
Many are called these days to that task, but it remains a sacred one. I should tell people, in case there are any on the planet who don't know, that you're, of course, Jonah Goldberg, columnist for the L.A. Times, author of the best-selling book, Liberal Fascism, and I'm Bob Wright of Blogging Heads TV. And by the way, I read in the trade press, Jonah, that you signed a contract for another book and got, like, a really humongous advance. Is that true?
I got a very nice deal.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
You sound a little reluctant to talk about it. Maybe I should press you on it further.
I am reluctant to talk about it, because the headline is more lavish than the reality, but I got a very nice deal. I'm very happy for it. I'm glad that my first book was as successful as it was, that it warranted a follow-on of generous proportions.
Now, in this next book, I hope you're not going to say anything unkind about liberals, Jonah. You've pretty much got that out of your system, don't you?
Completely. I now think they are just the cat's pajamas and a wonderful bunch of people.
And that's not part of the appeal from the publisher's point of view, that you might say any more unkind things about. Because I read that it was kind of a conservative house.
It's Penguin Sentinel, and they do some conservative books, but they also do, as far as I can tell, a lot of liberal books, and they do a lot of business books. So, but it was a four-way auction, and there were some houses that bid on it quite generously that are not necessarily objectively, conservative or anything either.
You make a good point. I'm waiting for the liberal publishing houses to start feeling their oats, or to start existing even.
Really, right? You really think there's a huge, that's what this country desperately needs, is a publishing house with more liberals in it? I mean, that's what's been lacking all of this time.
I think most publishers are what would the term be? Ideological, without practical ideology. Whatever the views of their editors, they'll sign up anything that they think will sell. Pretty much, I think.
I think that is generally true, but I have not heard of a lot of horror stories about. Publishers tanking or screwing up liberal books for reasons that have to do at least in part with ideology. And I've heard many such stories about conservative books getting monkey wrenched from within the publishing house because of ideological differences.
That makes me sad to think that would happen, Jonah.
I'm sorry to, because it's a festive time of year, and I don't want to make it.
This is really a downer for me. I gotta say, you've really taken the wind out of my sails with these reports of conservatives running into misfortune. So what are we gonna? We're gonna talk about a little bit about something topical, healthcare. Is that the idea?
I think that's the plan. We're gonna start off with the eat your spinach stuff, as we were saying earlier, and and then move into the 72 virgins category.
And at last report, healthcare reform was losing altitude, and they were, like, jettisoning various liberal, parts of it, like public option and the stand-ins for the public option, like lowering the age threshold for Medicare and stuff like that. So there's a general sense of loss of momentum. Am I reading this right?
Well, much of the metaphor is perfect. I mean, I think there's a loss of altitude. I think you're right. I think that the grandiose utopian scheme of public option and all the rest, that is going out as ballast. But the reason they're throwing the ballast out is to make it across the finish line. And it seems to me that jettisoning that stuff is getting them closer to the finish line. So it's in order to sustain the momentum to get it, to get it done, right?
I mean,
it sounds like it's going to be done, and it sounds to me like there's still lots of bad things in it from a conservative free market perspective, but it's an improvement from my perspective, and it's making it worse from, dare I say, your perspective.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not a real healthcare nerd. I was kind of hoping they'd do more than it looks like they're going to do. And by the way, if people wonder why we're belaboring this balloon race metaphor, we're masterfully paving the way for later when we may talk about the balloon boy thing in reality TV and stuff. There's going to be a real symmetry to this dialogue.
That's right. It's almost Tolstoy-esque foreshadowing we're doing right now.
Yeah. Perhaps a little too overt now that I've said that. But
yeah,
Yeah, I'm disappointed. I mean, and I thought all along, I don't know enough about the legislative process to say these kinds of things, but I thought all along the Obama should have had his troops a little more in line. I should have had a clearer idea of the package. I mean, it seemed to me eerily reminiscent of the Clinton experience in the early 90s when, at the beginning of the administration, rather than say, okay, we've got this health care package, we've thought about it, this is what we want to do, they said, let's do a bunch of studies and have a bunch of task forces. They skipped the task forces, but they did kind of throw it into Congress in quite, you know, amorphous form with the explicit idea that Congress would then, you know, that we would let politics have its way and see what came out at the other end, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I see it a little differently. I think that the significance of 1994 or 93, whatever, is for the Democrats, they seem to have concluded that their great mistake with Hillary Care was not getting something passed. And from a political vantage point, I'm not saying necessarily from a ideological standpoint, although I would add that in if necessary. From a political vantage point, it seems to me that the real mistake was them trying. And the political consequences, they seem to now think that as long as they get something passed, they'll be in great shape, or that it's worth doing by some calculus. And it seems to me that, you know, ramming through something that is, you know, now proven to be quite unpopular is going to have real political consequences for the Democratic Party in the short term. In the long term, I think it's probably good for the Democratic Party.
But when you say it's unpopular, well, I want to get back to unpopular. First of all, what do you mean by in the long run it's going to be good for the Democratic Party?
Well, I mean, I think this is one of the reasons why I think Byron York had a good piece in The Examiner yesterday where he talked to some 800-pound gorilla Democratic political consultant who tried to explain to Byron anonymously, which I thought was interesting, why the Democrats are going for something that in a slew of polls, not just one poll, but a slew of polls, is proving to be quite unpopular with the American people. Either, you know, the best it comes out is a small majority of the American people don't like the health care bill. And in several polls, apparently, it gets into the, you know, well into the 60s, don't mm-hmm. like it. And this guy's analysis had to do with, you know, it's an honorable thing about the Democrats. They've wanted to do this since FDR, and they're determined, they think they can do it now, and if they don't do it now, they won't be able to do it again for a generation. So they're going to ram it through. One of the interesting things, it seems to me, about the transformation of Congress is that the committee chairs, particularly in the Democratic Party, have become much more ideological than the average member. It used to be, remember, you had these Southern conservative Democratic committee chairs who were much more conservative than the rank and file. Now it's mm-hmm. completely flipped, and the committee chairs are much more liberal. You know, Waxman and all those guys, the leadership generally, are much more liberal than the rank and file. And so they're willing, Rangel and Waxman and these guys are willing to throw all of these moderate Dems under the bus in the next election in order to get this passed, which I think is interesting. And but I think if you look at it from, say, 30,000 feet, to get closer to the balloon metaphor, why I think this is smart for the Democrats in the long haul is because I think that this is part of the ongoing progressive project that traces itself at least back to FDR, which is to turn the American public, or vast swaths of the American public.
John, we're not going to go all the way back to the fascist roots of liberalism here, are we?
No, you're
gonna
stop,
are you going to stop at FDR?
Well, I'll stop at FDR.
But okay. Now, sorry. Go ahead. Sorry.
But it is an attempt to turn citizens into clients, right? You know, that the FDR coalition were a bunch of people who got, you know, organized labor, all the rest, get things from government. And mm-hmm. I think what the long-term strategy here is, if you get this program, you know, in place, it'll have a lot of problems at first, but over the long haul, once Americans start getting checks or stuff from the government, they never want to give it back. And that's the point about Medicare, right, is that, you know, once you're in it, you like it because it's yours and you think you're entitled to it, and that's why it's an entitlement. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the long-term strategy is, you know, as the party of government, is to get more people to have a vested stake in the government. And that will be good for them in the long haul, I fear.
Hmm. It could be. You really think they're thinking of it that way?
I think some
are. I mean,
are.
It seems to me they operate under very short-term kind of incentives.
Well, you'd think that, but if that were the case, they would tank. They wouldn't do what they're doing, right? I mean, if they just – I mean, in many ways, this is exactly the kind of leadership that everyone says that they want, right? I mean, I'm saying something nice about Democrats here.
Right.
Everyone says that we want politicians who don't listen to the polls, who act on their core convictions and all the rest. And that seems to me to be fairly what – I mean, I disagree with their core convictions, but that seems to me to be exactly what the Democrats are doing.
Yeah, I mean, that you're right. That it isn't just what people have been saying politicians should do. It's what politicians were supposed to do when we originally set up this system of government. It's a representative democracy, and the founders intended it for it to be that. And the idea was not that every piece of policy would be put up to popular vote, but that, you know, the legislators would come, do their best, and if you don't like it, you get rid of them in 2 years or 6 years. And it seems to me technology has kind of eroded that whole layer of insulation between day-to-day popular opinion and the legislative process. So in that sense, I would think you're championing this problem, right? What's that?
Also, direct election of senators was a problem. But I don't want to go back to the progressives.
Well, but
I'm sorry.
I think technology has made this a lot worse. Look, 30 years ago, certainly 40, you wouldn't have had these daily public opinion polls that we were checking in with to you know, gauge the fate of legislation. And you have to admit, Joni, you say it's getting less and less popular. I actually don't think that's an accurate way to describe it, because if by it you mean the actual legislation, I think you'll have to admit that most people in these opinion polls have no idea what they're talking about. I don't even have a very clear idea, you know, and I like to think I'm slightly better informed than the average American being in the business of you know, talking about this stuff. But you've got to admit that to say that the American people are souring on this legislation is just basically to talk about who's won the latest round of propaganda, right? You don't honestly think that these polls reflect actual knowledge of what's in the legislation.
No, not really.
I'm
not sure that it's – I mean, I'm not a big defender of the innate wisdom of the American people as reflected in polls. I am a defender of the innate wisdom of the American people over the long run, but I don't think polls take very good snapshots of it, and I think that both parties and both sides tend to – I mean, it's classic lawyer arguing, right? You know, you cite the polls when they're in your favor, and you denounce the stupidity of polls when they're not in your favor. But I'm not sure it's pure propaganda. I think that the American people are hearing a lot of things about the health care bill that I would argue are largely true. They don't like what they hear. Now, it may be, and as some people, you know, have argued from the left, that the good things in the healthcare bill aren't being touted enough, and that may be true, and a better defender of the sausage would do a better job of selling it, but I'm not sure that it is complete, you know, fantasy land made up, you know, stuff that American people are buying into about the healthcare bill. I think they're hearing things, and they don't like it.
But, Joan, it seems to me you can't have it both ways. On the one hand, your grand theory of the Democrats' motivation is that they are going to give people something that the people are going to like once they see what it is, right? They're going to actually like having it once they see what having it is. You can't turn around then and say that their rejection of this right now reflects an accurate understanding of what it is, right?
Oh, look, your point is simply that it's a giant mess with lots of contradictions out there. Yeah, but I mean, at the same time, we normally expect politicians to go with what the polls tell them. And
but you don't think we should expect that, right? You don't think that's good governance, do you?
No, not necessarily.
Okay, neither do I. We agree. So we're both in favor of the passage of health care legislation.
No. I think that I like what the Democrats are doing, or at least I'm hoping. My rosy scenario as a knuckle-dragging, troglodytic right-winger is that they do pass a Mondo omnibus health care thing. They go all in. The Democratic Party is completely, completely associated with this because there's no bipartisanship whatsoever, and I think bipartisanship is overrated. And then I hope that the conservative predictions and analysis of how this is going to work are correct, and the thing is a giant cock-up. And I think that the Democrats are gambling that the American people are going to like it. They may be right. That scares the hell out of me. But my hope is that the Democrats, in fact, pay a terrible, terrible price for this, which is what democracy is supposed to be about,
right? Legislation that will lead to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. Is that the way you would put your position, Jonah?
I'm a great believer in political accountability, right? Edmund Burke has this great line where he says, "Example is the school of mankind, and it will learn it no other." We learn from our mistakes, right? I mean, this is what FDR and liberals are supposed to believe in: bold, persistent experimentation, right? Well, the Democratic Party is conducting a massive experiment. Obama at the beginning of his administration touted FDR's experimentation as his lodestar. Well, this is a huge experiment that they're playing, and they're playing with the lives of millions of people, no matter how you slice it.
Yeah, and you're saying you want them to fail in a way that will be detrimental to those lives and to the American economy, right? As I understand you.
I want it to fail as quickly and as starkly as possible.
As painlessly as possible. After a few hundred deaths, and you want to see that...
I know you're really trying to bait me as Recline style here, but... I don't want people to die, obviously, but I want the healthcare thing to be, if it's going to be a failure, and I think it is, I would like it to be evident very quickly that it's a failure.
Yeah.
And I would like there to be a huge political backlash. I don't want it to be a political backlash based on millions dying. I want it to be a political backlash because of millions being charged too much and inconvenienced by a stupid way of organizing public policy. I'm not a big defender of the status quo. I despise the status quo with healthcare.
And nobody dies. It's just an economic calamity for the United States that you wish for. No deaths.
I'd rather the thing fail. I mean, I'd rather it not pass at all. But if it's going to pass, I want the Democrats to own it. I want them to be held responsible for it.
Yeah.
And, and that's how democracy is supposed to work, right? I mean, I think parties are, the differences between parties have been too blurred in the past. And I want clear reminders. And look, if the Democrats succeed... Bully for them. If this turns out to be great public policy, then hooray for Democrats, right? That's good for the Democratic Party. I like that they're putting their balls in the sling on this, and they're risking a lot. I wish we saw that more from the Republican Party. I wish we really saw more Hail Mary passes in American politics.
So with this balls in a sling and Hail Mary thing, we're moving away from the balloon race metaphor, am I right?
Oh, I apologize. I apologize.
That's okay. It's okay. It's okay. Okay, anything else you want to say about healthcare? I thought after trying to stigmatize you forever, the least I could do for you is let you have the last word.
No, it's okay. I'm in favor of stigma, too, so that's all right.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's stigmatism. Stigmatization has been very good to you, I'd say. here's a masterful segue. So we were talking, I was like kind of half mock accusing you of wanting a bunch of people, wanting this failure that would be calamitous. Mm-hmm. Of course, you may remember that during the Iraq War, liberals were accused of wanting the war to fail at the expense of American lives, a kind of a comparable accusation. And the Iraq War reminds me of the Afghanistan War. And the Afghanistan War reminds me of this kind of op-ed exchange you and I had that we were going to talk about, right?
That's right. That's right. And I have to say, your segue was like a pirouette. It was lovely.
If I hadn't told people it was coming, they would not have noticed it. It was so smooth.
That's right.
I don't know. Do you want? So this is about Major Hassan.
Right. Why don't you state your absurd case from the New York Times, and then I'll respond to it.
Okay. Can I ask you one question though about your op-ed? I mean, but I don't want us to get too distracted on this. But you wrote this thing. In the LA Times after the Fort Hood shooting, to which I replied, but you said in the first paragraph, we've learned various things. For starters, Major Hassan showed, as you put it, that evil is still thriving.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to ask you, this is a common conservative talking point to say evil exists as if liberals disagree. And I'm not always clear on what you mean by evil. What is this evil thing that you guys believe in and we don't believe exists?
Well, I mean, this is a whole different topic. I mean, it's a bit of a blindside. I think that...
Okay, well, we can back up and let your unconscious mind work on it.
I'll give you my quick response to it. I'm a big fan of a book by Andrew Del Banco called The Death of Satan. Satan, came out about 15 years ago. And he argues that one of the problems that you get with sort of secular liberalism, and I think he is a pretty secular liberal himself, he's a literature professor, but is that with the sort of peeling away of religious notions from secular liberal discourse, you lose the capacity to talk about evil as an objective or ontological thing, right? And instead, everything has an explanation. There's always some other factor or some, or the system to blame. Mm-hmm. And it all becomes sort of contingency and relativism and whatnot. And I think that the conservative perspective, speaking very broadly here, is that evil is a thing. You can't talk about there being good in the world unless you're willing to talk about there being evil in the world to a certain extent. And the inability of society to talk about evil absent a sort of root causes explanation and all of the rest, I think sometimes hinders us and makes it more difficult for us to look at the world the way it really is. I would say evil, understanding evil is a kind of realism, and I know you're a big believer in realism.
Of various sorts, but there's so many kinds of realism, I'm not sure how much that helps. Yeah, well, you know, actually, we should reserve a whole dialogue for this, I think. This is a lot of interesting terrain. I mean, I guess I would just say that I think, though, what Del Banco is saying, not, having not read his book, but just listened to your summary, is that really, the way I would put it is that the movement to a modern kind of, scientific worldview almost is what endangers the concept of evil as traditionally understood. And if you want to buy into a scientific frame of mind, you got to deal with that and figure a way around it. Are you saying we shouldn't embrace a scientific worldview in which we think everything does basically have a cause, or?
Well, I think sometimes people who invoke science are really guilty of scientism. And they try to find in science things that, science is very good at things that science is very good at. But life cannot be reduced. I know that this comes very close to some of your areas of expertise and quickly departs mine, but I don't think that all of human life can be reduced to scientific explanations. And I think we get ourselves into great trouble when we try to do that, when we try to import from science things that cannot be imported from science. Science itself can be good and science can be evil. Science is a tool. Depends what you use it for. And I think a lot of people, they sort of beg the question and sort of sneak in this idea that science in and of itself is good. And I think there's much that is good about science, but it is in many ways, it is neither good nor evil. It is simply science.
This could be a whole hour of discussion. And I would actually like to set that up and do it. Maybe what we should do is move to the actual argument we're having is in some respects a concrete illustration of this argument, because I think maybe, tell me if I'm wrong, it bothers you a little the extent to which I'm positing causes for Major Hassan's behavior. But let's back up and say that basically my argument was, first, I think you did this before Charles Krauthammer did it, right, in the wake of the shooting, when I agree with you, liberals and liberal newspapers were very reluctant to connect the shooting to Islamic extremism, and to some extent intent on, as I think you maybe put it, medicalizing it, right? Mm-hmm. And saying, it was post-traumatic stress, it was this, it was that, it has nothing to do with his identity as a Muslim. And you said, look, they're dodging the issue. The guy said God is great as he, in Arabic, as he did this, he was in touch with this radical imam and blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
And then I wrote a piece saying, you're right. This is not unrelated to the fact that he's a Muslim and a radical Muslim. But let's look at more specifically what the causes were. And I think when you look at it, it bears out kind of a more liberal view of what the war on terrorism should be about. Specifically, I said, he, by everyone's account, was outraged over the number of Muslims being killed in Afghanistan and Iraq by American troops and so on, and very ill at ease at, over the position he felt he had been put in being deployed in a combat zone where lots of Muslims were being killed by the people on his side. And I said, you know, from the beginning, I think liberals, at least the ones I identify with, have been saying, do not focus so much on killing terrorists that you wind up spreading the terrorism meme, okay? And I would say that in this case, what we see is that two wars we were conducting abroad to try to kill terrorists were having the effect of spreading the virus of terrorism, and in this case, it was conveyed to this guy's brain, and so I thought the liberal view stood a little bit vindicated, and that's where, and we haven't really talked about it since, so that's where the argument
yeah,
stands.
Yeah, I mean, and so, you know, I had a very mixed reaction. I didn't get a chance to reread your op-ed right before this, so if I'm remembering it wrong, you'll correct me. In fact, if I'm remembering it right, you might
correct I'll still
me too.
Correct you.
It seems to me that, first of all, there was I had a huge so what problem with your op-ed. I'm perfectly willing to concede, for the sake of argument at least, that Hassan was activated, right? The radical terrorist switch was flipped in his head by the war in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
Stipulated, you know, for the sake of argument. So what? Certainly that's not an argument against the war. It's not a dispositive argument against the war in Afghanistan, is it? You know, there were all sorts of people, thousands, millions for all I know, of people in colonial America who had their pro-British switch flipped during the Revolutionary War. That's not an argument against the Revolutionary War. For all I know, there were lots of people in the North who were in favor of going to war, who took the South side during the Civil War, and by going to war, they started killing people in the North. That doesn't mean that the North was wrong in the Civil War. I mean, there are some costs that are going to come with any war, no matter how just or mm-hmm. or certainly unjust, right? That's going to happen. And simply saying, well, if we hadn't invaded Afghanistan, there'd be no Major Hassan, isn't all that interesting or persuasive an argument to me. Okay. It's certainly not enough to defeat the entire argument for being in Afghanistan.
Well, it may or may not be, but first, do you grant the legitimacy of just pointing to costs that are likely to be incurred? In other words, do you agree that whatever the moral virtues of a war, it makes sense before launching a war to conduct, to the extent that you can, a cost-benefit analysis and I would argue, by the way, that that's ultimately moral, because if the good cause you're fighting for is going to be defeated, if the cost of launching the good war is that ultimately the good cause you're fighting for is going to be defeated, well, that's a moral argument. So in my mind, cost-benefit analyses are not outside the realm of morality, because you're talking about costs and benefits with moral valence, okay? So
yeah, no, I agree with that entirely. Look, I mean, if it would have cost us one soldier's life, or it would cost us $1 to topple the regime in Iran tomorrow, it would be a no-brainer to do it in my book. But if it cost millions of lives or cost trillions of dollars, then you got to think twice about it. It's all
right.
Cost-benefit analysis is important in all of these things.
Right. But okay, so you grant that, you know, and part of my motivation, frankly, is when we launched the Iraq War, this is the kind of thing I was pointing to and opposing it. So I'm just saying, do we at least agree now that, yes, these costs can happen and you're entitled to point to them in arguing for or against a war? I mean, the second point I would make is that in this case, although, of course, the number of people killed at Fort Hood sounds small in the scheme of things, the fact is that I think this kind of thing puts us potentially on a slippery slope toward complete catastrophe. The worst thing that can come out of the war on terror, the biggest triumph for bin Laden would be if our society, which so far has been a beacon of not just democracy, but, you know, multi-ethnic amity to a greater extent than you find in other parts of the world, as the Europeans are finally learning, now that they actually have some ethnic diversity, they're learning it's not easy to do this. And we've done it pretty successfully. And if we blow this, if this country falls apart along ethnic lines, that is the ultimate triumph for bin Laden and the ultimate failure for us and the ultimate moral failure. And what I'm saying is, if you look at the dynamics by which that could happen, even though this was only 14 lives, and even though the comparable case shortly, a few months before it was resulted in only two Americans being killed, this dynamic scares me because it can have positive feedback effect. It can feed on itself. And in fact, Major Hassan is said to have been inspired by that previous killing of two soldiers by an American Muslim. So I'm just making two points. A, it's legitimate to point to this as a cost, and I think you're granting that. B, this could be a very, very big kind of cost that ultimately, even in moral terms, overwhelms the reason, the logic behind for which the wars were initially launched.
Yeah, okay, well, and that's my other problem with all of this. I mean, I just don't buy that, you know, the infecting agent is purely America's misdeeds, right? I mean, the guys who attacked us on 9/11 did so before the Iraq War and before the war in Afghanistan. They did it
right
in part to get our troops out of Saudi Arabia, right? Well, our troops were in Saudi Arabia in part because of the first Iraq War. Were you against the first Iraq War?
I do not condemn it in retrospect. At the time, I was arguing for a kind of halfway measure that I think, in retrospect, was a stupid idea, which would have been a kind of a punitive bombing of Hussein. But I will say about the Persian Gulf War, it was a textbook legal war sanctioned by the Security Council for a manifest violation of the Charter of the United Nations. So I'm fine with it. I'm fine with it.
Okay, well, you know, and that war had consequences that set off a lot of these jihadi guys. I mean, the idea, it seems to me that putting the onus of the creation, you know, that saying that all these jihadis are being created by American actions, even if accurate, which I don't think is in every case is accurate, isn't all that much of a blockbuster point in favor of the policies that you support. It seems to me that, you know, our intervention in Bosnia, which was exploited by bin Laden and those guys quite a bit, was still entirely morally justified. Our intervention, you know, bin Laden didn't want the Saudis to bring in the American troops. He said, we can do it here. We did it in Afghanistan. Leave it to us. And the fact that the Saudis disagreed with him is one of the things that made him, you know, radicalize even more. That doesn't mean that we were wrong to go in to liberate Kuwait. There are all sorts of things that, even though they have these costs that you're talking about, are still warranted and worthwhile. And the Islamist, jihadi ideology has roots that go, back much further and are fairly independent from the foreign policy mistakes that you think are central.
Well, that's a much longer argument. Certainly, I don't think you would say that the Iranian Revolution of 79 had no connection to the coup we had sponsored in Iran to depose a democratically elected government. But that's a much larger argument. The my main point, and to a large extent, my point was, look, we had these two competing models of what the great terrorist threat is, what we really have to worry about in terms of the next terrorist attack. We had this liberal model about make sure you don't spread the terrorism meme and then we had the conservative model, which is more like go kill the terrorists and launch the wars you have to. One thing I'm saying is, look, some data is now in. We have actually had what I agree with you is a terrorist attack on American soil, and it comports with the liberal model and not with the conservative model. This was not an agent deployed by Al-Qaeda, which benefited from safe haven in Afghanistan or anything like that. It was an American guy, and the virus was spread, and I'm saying one thing that spread it and pushed this guy past critical mass is a couple of American wars, one of which I argued strongly against and thought was very ill-advised. So I'm just saying, so far, the data that's in terms of actual terrorist attacks on American soil since 9/11 is consistent with the liberal model, not the conservative model.
I'm going to ponder that more. I think that you are you're not doing justice to the conservative model. I mean, certainly counterinsurgency theory, which we've been having a big argument about low these past few months, is not a let's just go kill the terrorists theory, right?
No, in fact, that is the belated adoption of a more liberal model, but that's after we've gotten ourselves mired in a couple of wars.
Well, and George Bush never, as to my knowledge, took the anti-Islam point of view, right? I mean, he was always talking about Islam as a religion of peace and all that sort of thing.
Well, he pretty much said the right things, yes. But launching the Iraq War, I thought was just a mistake. I'm not saying everything he did was wrong.
Okay, well, I just it seems to me that that first of all, there should be by the liberal interpretation, right? There should be a lot more terrorist attacks on the whole by your formula. There should be a hell of a lot more Major Hassans on American soil, and there aren't, right? And it seems to me that the best way to deter the creation of more Hassans in the long run, particularly Hassans who are running regimes with nuclear weapons and all that kind of thing, is to break the back of Islamic terrorist organizations and to show that they can't win. And I think, Bin Laden was onto something. Certainly he was onto something about the psychology of his contemporaries when he did that whole bit, strong horse, weak horse spiel.
Right.
And caving, the policy conclusions that you're advocating are basically to give Bin Laden and these guys the opportunity to say, see, we won. And I don't think that – I think there's a lot of data.
He's saying, see, we won when an American Muslim – shoots up 14 soldiers on American soil. He's having a very good night.
Yeah, he also said, we won when we got out of Mogadishu. He said, we won when we got out of Yugoslavia. I think these guys are looking for reasons to declare victory. I think Bob Gates is pretty persuasive on this, that if we got out of Afghanistan now, they would say, aha, see, we did it to the Soviets, now we did it to the Americans. Mm-hmm. And
well,
that would create more Hassans in my point of view than doubling down in Afghanistan.
Well, yeah, it's an empirical question. All I'm saying is the one admittedly slender. Well, there's a couple of data points now, but they are. They tend to corroborate the liberal model. Maybe you're right that the liberal model would stand more strongly vindicated if there had been a bunch of these things. That's true, and in that sense, I'm glad I have not been thoroughly vindicated. But I will say, and as for why that is, I would say, for one thing, we should be really grateful for the Muslim population we have in America. It's much less amenable to the terrorist meme than the Muslim population in some European countries. But I'm saying that Major Hassan shows we can only push our luck so far, and we have to start being mindful of the potential calamity that really could afflict us if we're not careful, but I don't know. I'll give you the last word, and then we can, if there's anything you want to say, and we can move on.
Yeah, I think we've covered it. I just think that you are over-interpreting a very small data set.
Yeah, well, it is a small data set. I'm grateful for that, but yeah. So we were going to talk about a couple of more things that we think may be related.
You want to talk
related.
Tiger.
Talk about Tiger. I'm sorry. I feel so bad. I cannot get enough of this story. I play a little golf. Do you play golf, Jonas?
I really don't. No. I want to pick it up as a hobby. I would like to, but I'm the world's worst two-legged golfer.
Well, it's a great game because it's the ultimate head game. I mean, it's so much about your control of your head, which is one of several reasons I'm a horrible golfer. And Tiger, one of the just amazing things about him is the complete imperviousness of his psychology on the golf course to what's going on. I mean, that guy has got focus that I think is actually related to some of the things that have happened to him now. I mean, one thing he has is no self-doubt, okay? on the golf course and in life, and I think that's what led him to take risks that are coming back to haunt him. He just, you know, he does think he's the chosen one. I think his father drilled that into his head. But anyway, that's the golfer's take on what's happened to him. What is your reaction to this thing, Ben?
I gotta tell you, I have not. I will confess, as a red-blooded American male, I very much like the TMZ and New York Post coverage and cleavage, and I find a lot of it amusing. You know, I had to do some TV show a couple weeks ago or a week ago where I had to talk about Tiger, and frankly, you know, I don't have any great take on it. I don't want to get into the. I mean, I'm perfectly happy to do this sort of neocon virtucrat, you know, kind of take on it, but I'm not so invested that I really care about, you know, which one of these bimbos is a hooker and which one isn't. So I find
blurry line in this case, but
yeah, I find it to be an interesting soap opera. I think it's I can't mount a lot of sympathy for him. I can't mount a strong defense for how the media is covering it. I think it's just one of these things that is sort of part of the hurly-burly of American life.
But you are drawn, you're saying, to the conservative line that, hey, one thing, the conservative complaint that, hey, one thing almost nobody's talking about is, damn it, what he did is bad, right? I mean, you want to see more moral sanction brought to bear here.
Well, you know, look, I mean, I think the beauty of moral turpitude clauses in sponsorship contracts is bringing quite a bit of sanction. And for a guy like Tiger, who, as you say, is so tightly wrapped in his head and a control freak and all of the rest, this – and I saw what his yacht is called, Privacy or something like that, you know. This has got to be a living hell for the guy. So, I mean, there's serious moral sanction going on. And I do think – I mean, it's sort of as a – sort of a just a profile of the male – ego, I think it is kind of interesting. You know, my understanding is that, you know, Tiger was actually a pretty dorky guy in college, and now he's...
He was not a ladies' man in college?
That is my understanding. But,
he certainly had superstar status at Stanford, I'm sure. I'm sure everybody knew who he was on campus.
Yeah, I'm just saying, I think he, you know, this is a guy who was very tightly controlled by his dad for a very long time, and then all of a sudden he's this global celebrity on par with Michael Jordan, and, you know, and... Yeah. He hangs out with people like Derek Jeter and all these guys, and all of a sudden, you know, he's doing the things that he thinks. I mean, maybe his wife is the most wonderful, down to earth person, and it was a match made in heaven, and all of the rest. But there are certain conclusions one can draw when a near billionaire marries a Swedish bikini model, and I just sort of I think sort of his following of his. Male ego, let's say, is sort of an interesting thing to witness. I mean, these are all a certain type of woman.
Was the phrase male ego a last-minute substitute in that sentence, John?
It was. I was trying to avoid a Lyndon Johnson-esque euphemism.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess you're getting at one thing that makes me reluctant to get on my moral high horse. I mean, on the one hand, I mean, I do think it would be for the good of society if this kind of stuff was negatively sanctioned, you know. I think just in a utilitarian sense, marriage is a pretty efficient way to raise the next generation. Okay. This sort of thing, to the extent that this becomes rampant, is a danger to marriage. Human psychology is such that you can't just have, I think, free love and have all marriages survive. So it's like, on the one hand, I'm against it. On the other hand, I do have a kind of a there but for the grace of God go I feeling, very much along the lines that you're suggesting. Is like, look, you put me in his shoes, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old, and the world is your oyster, and almost every woman you see, well, some high percentage of women you see, look as if they would settle for something less than a lifelong commitment, right? You know, your mind is going to wander. And And I said the same thing about Clinton. I don't know how many – it's easy for the rest of us to sit here and talk about how good we are, but it's that's a lot of temptation.
Well, let me throw this out here, because, I mean, you know, as you know, I'm a huge fan of Moral Animal and all of that. And you know, your Darwinian understanding of these things might be helpful. It seems to me that, you know, one of the classic arguments that you'll get from the sort of neocon school on these things, you know, the Irving Kristol school on these things, is that the rich can afford their vices more than the poor, which is one reason why the rich have an obligation to, at least in public, behave a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, one of my favorite examples is Madonna. It drove me crazy. I must have written three columns on it. When Madonna became a mom, she got all of this glowing press coverage about how, you know, the material girl settles down, she's the new role model mom, and all this kind of stuff. And you know, and this from a woman who, you know, 10 years earlier was the foremost proselytizer of slattern chic. And the problem with it is that, you know, she says in one interview, I have no problem with changing diapers because I've never changed a diaper in my entire life. She has staff to do it. She's like an entourage of 200 people.
Mm-hmm.
And so for people like Madonna, or people like Tiger Woods, they can, as a pure economic sense, afford their sins in a way that a assistant plumber can't. And yet we have a celebrity culture now, and this is getting us to our last topic too, we have a celebrity culture now which sort of says if, you know, they should be able to get, celebrities should be able to get away with pretty much anything. If it feels good, do it. We have this voyeuristic attitude towards their escapades and all of the rest. And the concern is that people who do not have the literal capital, not just the social capital, but the actual money to behave the same way, are going to pick up these habits, and it's going to be terribly destructive for them.
Right.
So is that a concern of yours? Because, you know, to make this argument with most conventional liberals, you know, because it seems to me that so much of conventional liberalism is so obsessed with the sin of hypocrisy over all others, that this argument does not have much traction with normal liberals.
Yeah, no, it does with me, and it gets to something I may write about this and may not. But I mean, first of all, on hypocrisy, I think that hypocrisy, as others have said, is you know, often essential to the functioning of a robust moral system. And one concern of mine is that technology is making it harder to maintain this vital hypocrisy in the following sense, that in Victorian England, you know, yes, the upper class men were fooling around with prostitutes or whatever, and whatever was going on was going on. But you didn't have this technology of transparency that made it so likely that these things would be globally exposed at a moment's notice. I mean, if you look at Tiger Woods, David Letterman, in all of these cases, the footprints that are left by them are left by this pervasive digital electronic communication. And you know, like Tiger's, the message he left on that woman's machine and so on. So in Victorian England, I think it was much easier to maintain the pretense that nobody's fooling around, even though, yes, some upper class men were, but two things. They were not doing it in a way that endangered the institution of marriage, okay? Not that that itself is vindication of it. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying in terms of the cost paid, there was some damage control in Victorian England. They did not let it, you know, endanger the institution of marriage. And one reason for that was when something was exposed, there was real sanction, you know. Charles Dickens had to have an extramarital affair under the most absurd conditions because it would have been so ruinous had it gotten out. Whereas now, if a writer has an extramarital affair, right? I mean, that's a yawn.
Part of their mystique as a writer, almost, right?
I mean, right, exactly. And so, no, I share my concern is that you know, you have the transparency thing. On the one hand, it makes people like Tiger more fearful in theory and might get them to clean up their act because it's just, I think, getting harder and harder for these people to get away with anything with any confidence. But on the other hand, the very same thing, you know, the source of that fear, which is the likelihood of exposure, is having the effect of what you conservatives are, well, I guess Moynihan coined the phrase, defining deviancy down. In other words, making everything seem acceptable. And so this is my the way I would frame the problem.
Yeah, I think we agree entirely. I very much like the Victorian model in many ways, where you could get as jiggy and as weird as you wanted behind closed doors, and I think a lot of those dudes did. But in public, there was a notion of constraining moralism for everybody. That was inconvenient for everybody. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that the costs for not just infidelity, but for all sorts of, indiscretions and whatnot, has gotten so low so as to be almost inconsequential. Except, if you've got a huge Gatorade and Price Waterhouse or whatever endorsement deal. I mean, that's the sort of irony here, is that Tiger Woods is one of the few sort of public figures who is actually, because of his psychology and the way his income streams are designed, is actually paying a huge price in terms of sanction. But most don't,
Right. And it's a comment on her society, I think, that the question that hardly anybody is entertaining is, what effect will this have on his golf career? I mean, the real drama behind all this. I mean, I think, the hope for him is that he will literally just if I were him, I think the smart thing for him to do is say, I'm no longer a one-man corporation. Golf is what I was put on this earth to do, and that's my focus, and I don't do endorsements anymore, and I don't need to be rich, and I'm going to focus on the golf and become a better person in a way that's conducive to better golf. Because, by the way, he's been erratic on the golf course. I mean, there's evidence that this was taking a toll on his golf. But anyway, I digress. The point is, it's interesting to me that the barometer of the effect, of the toll he's taking is totally in this fake world of endorsements, when supposedly what the guy is a professional golfer who needs to win 5 more majors to become unequivocally the greatest player in the history of the game. It's weird.
And also, I mean, the thing is, if he was a Bill Clinton personality, it's not entirely clear that the punishment would bother him all that much, right? Part of the sense about the guy is that he is so tightly wrapped that having his whole life displayed on tabloid TV for weeks at a time has got to be hellish for him. But if he was more of a classic Lothario kind of personality, then this wouldn't necessarily be such a bad thing. He might be taking pride in all of these sorts of things. It's an interesting irony. I don't know.
The fascinating thing for me is going to be to see how it impacts his golf in the long run. That's the ultimate kind of mythic test here. That would be the ultimate collapse if he didn't win his five more majors, and it would ultimately. And on the other hand, he will ultimately be seen as having prevailed if he does, I think. But that's way off in the future. So you wrote a thing about reality TV that I think is not unrelated to this entirely, but you're not a big reality TV fan.
No, as a mindless consumer of television, there's some of it I like to watch. I mean, I watched this Jersey Shore show, which is truly an affront to all that is holy.
And yet you watch it.
But great TV. Yeah. And what was it Whitman said? If I contradict myself, that's fine. I contain multitudes. But I think it's really having a now. I mean, you're talking about data. The reality. This really was the decade of the reality show in a lot of ways. And if you want to talk about data, we now have a lot of data coming in on the impact of reality shows. And I think it's overwhelmingly negative. Part of the point I made in the piece is, we know from Toynbee, right? Toynbee has this theory of civilization.
I was interested to learn that in your piece. Go ahead.
Yeah, where as a theory of civilizational decay, where he says when the sort of creative mind, when the masses are trying to ape the mores and lifestyle and habits of the creative elite, civilizations flourish. When the creative elite starts to ape the mores and habits of the masses, societies and civilizations start to decay. And I think there's some validity to that. And one of the things we're seeing with reality show culture is that it's infectious for the upper classes as well. I mean, the Salahis are this great example of high-income people becoming totally sort of consumed with this desire to be exhibitionists on television. And they have the same sort of burning desire to be on TV, and all these other Real Housewives of Orange County and Real Housewives of Atlanta and all the rest, they're all these people who are just desperate to be in front of a camera. And I don't think that that is a, first of all, a terribly healthy impulse, and it doesn't say anything good about these people. But you see in some cases, like, you know, the Balloon Boy parents, they're so desperate to get land a reality show that they're willing to put on this, you know, elaborate hoax. And you get the sense that, you know, the Balloon Boy's dad thinks he's a failure if he's not on a, if he doesn't have a reality show. And, and you just, you look at the culture of it, and it seems to me that there's very, very little redeeming. I'm not for banning reality shows or anything like that, but they're pretty clearly a force for evil, you know, because, or for badness, because they tend to reinforce this idea that celebrity is earned nobility, and that self-expression is more important than self-discipline. And you watch this Jersey Shore thing, and it is just astounding that these guys think they're awesome and cool and great because they're on this reality show, and they don't have, as far as I can tell, I mean, some of them seem to be big-hearted, soft, you know, guys underneath their idiotic exterior, but on the whole, these are not redeeming or admirable people. And now they're being treated as honest-to-goodness celebrities, then people want their autographs and all the rest, and I don't think that's healthy. I don't think it sends a good signal.
Possibly not. I'm always reluctant to sympathize with that view because, you know, I'm getting older, and it is the tradition. Ever since things started changing fast, right, like at least as far, you know, back as the early 20th century and probably back into the late 19th, ever since things started changing fast so that within a single lifetime the technological environment and hence the cultural environment had changed, it has been the case that people who get to be my age start expressing dissatisfaction with the way the younger generation behaves, you know? And
but so that in and of itself doesn't mean they're wrong, does it?
That does not mean they're wrong. And in retrospect, my father, some of his concerns maybe have been borne out. It does not mean they're wrong. On the other hand, it seems to me evidence that it's sufficiently almost reflexive that you should really evaluate the reflex before you give play to it. Having said that, I wish these kids would get off my lawn, Jonah. I think this is related to the Tiger Woods thing in that, you know, the reality show is itself partly a product of technology. 40 years ago, it would have been really hard to do all the video and the editing that made these things happen. And as the Balloon Boy family illustrates, you can do your homegrown reality show. They were taping the fake launch of the balloon themselves and generating the footage, you know, and he was doing his YouTube video. So the line, you know, between kind of elaborate professional production and grassroots production is, of course, blurring. And this means not only is reality TV more feasible as like a network corporate enterprise, it's more feasible as a grassroots enterprise. Now, the segue I'm going to try to make here, the connection I'm going to try to make is, I think it's fundamentally the same technological dynamic that allowed all of Tiger Woods' bimbos to suddenly come to life, this technology of transparency. It first of all accounted for the evidence he left in his wake, and then it allowed them to just, you know, all of these women to suddenly dominate our computer screens and TV screens. So I think we're kind of seeing the same thing here. And in both cases, one of the concerns is defining deviancy down, right? I mean, when all of life becomes transparent and you indulge the natural human tendency to observe the most salacious parts of the life, it's a very different moral environment in which to grow up, right?
Right. Right. Just thinking about it now, here's one way to think about it. It seems. Tell me if you think this is crazy. You know, it used to be, I think, well-intentioned people of all ideological stripes, and particularly sort of responsible voices within the black community, bemoaned the tendency of a lot of inner-city black kids to think that their only way to a successful life was through basketball, right? You know, and just the odds of becoming a professional basketball player were so, astronomically high that it was a silly waste of one's energies and discipline. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, it can be overstated and all the rest, but I think, that, you know, it's a Bill Cosby-esque point that, as far as it goes, is, I think, correct. But at least with the sort of basketball obsession, you know, the basketball diary, you know, what was that? Not basketball diaries, that documentary, Hoop Dreams.
Hoop Dreams?
Yeah, Hoop Dreams. You know, at least with that, you had kids who were applying themselves through serious work and energy and discipline towards a goal that they might not be able to achieve, but at least they were working towards it.
Mm-hmm.
The signal that reality shows send is you don't have to work towards anything. Just be a self-indulgent jackass, and people will want to watch you, and you will become a celebrity and get rich just from indulging every and any impulse and bringing on the drama and all of the rest. And that cannot be a healthy signal for society. We just had a sort of technical glitch on Bob's side, and Blogging Heads had to stop suddenly. He offers his apologies, and that's all, folks. Thanks for tuning in, and be sure to watch another exciting episode of Blogging Heads. Thank you.